Session number 876.
So Frederick Coatsreel, one, before we talk about your military service, Sir Frederick, could you tell me a bit how you came to choose the army for a career?
Well, my grandfather, my mother's father was in the army, and my father had died before I left school, and I was recruited into, I was intending to join the Essex Regiment, but I was, my inclinations were changed to the Tank Corps by then Captain or Major Caunter, who was on the headquarters of Northern Ireland District at the time, and my mother knew him, and he suggested that I should try for the Tank Corps.
Why did he think that was a good idea?
And I felt it was a more modern arm, and it was an arm of the future rather than the infantry, I think.
Had you intended the army from a relatively young man, or was this a decision you took?
No, I think it was a conscious decision. My father was a stockbroker, and I could probably have gone into the stockbroking business, but the idea of sitting at an office desk did not attract me at that age.
When you joined the service, how did the army rate as a career? Was it a sort of high-status profession, would you say?
I don't... I would say it still was. Oh, yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think it was a very... inclined to be a hereditary profession. I think sons tended to go into the services if their fathers or relatives had. And, although my father wasn't in the service, it... my grandfather was, so I suppose that covers that.
I see. Now, your period in 1935 at Sandhurst, during the officer cadet training, did mechanisation in any form become involved in the sort of syllabus you were given there?
Yes, there was a school of mechanical engineering at Sandhurst, but as far as I remember, it was probably not more than voluntary. Mm-hmm. But I certainly took part in it, and I certainly went to it.
I asked the question...
And that was the case at my public school as well.
Oh, which school did you go to?
I was at Eton.
And you were in the army class there?
And I joined the army class there, yes.
The reason I asked you the question about attention given at Sandhurst to mechanisation is I was interested in how far attention to mechanized warfare was reflected by the cadet training that was given at that time.
Yes, it would be hard to say, but I should think probably not an awful lot.
You said you originally intended to go into the Essex Regiment, change your mind for the Tank Corps for reasons which you've given. When you took that decision, did you have any particular reactions to it from either the staff or your fellow students at Sandhurst? I wondered how
No, I don't think so. I think that the officer at Sandhurst, who was responsible for the Essex Regiment, was disappointed because it had been my grandfather's regiment. I don't recall anything else.
I was wondering what the status of the Tank Corps was within the army in 1935?
I think it was beginning to be recognised by then, you see. 35, 30. I was commissioned in 36, January 36. So, as you say, I passed out of Sandhurst in 35, and I would have thought the Tank Corps was definitely beginning to be recognised then.
Mm-hmm. Certainly people I've recorded who joined the Tank Corps in the 20s, for example, very often the reactions of their contemporaries were somewhat horrific that they should choose this relatively young corps.
Yes, but I wouldn't have said that was quite so much the case by the mid-30s. And of course, we were beginning to be, I mean, had already been in some cases recognised as the training arm for the mechanised forces, because the cavalry were gravely being mechanised. Several regiments had already been mechanised by the time I was commissioned, and more were going on, and there were cavalry officers on courses at Bovington, or beginning to come on courses at Bovington when I was there.
Mm. You said one of the reasons you chose the Tank Corps was because you thought it was a forward-looking arm. Did that expectation of it, was that expectation of it confirmed when you went to Bovington by your experiences there?
I think perhaps not as much as one might have hoped. But on the other hand, Bovington, like everywhere else in those days, was very, very, very limited by money and availability of equipment and so on.
Could you elaborate a bit by not as much as one might have hoped?
Well, I think although there were in certain parts, General Hubbard's tank brigade, Hobo's tank brigade on Salisbury Plain, prior to that or at the same time, were inventing the tactics which were afterwards to be used by us and against us. I don't think that sort of training had penetrated down to Bovington much. That was my impression. I certainly remember that. I definitely recall when we'd done our tactical course that most of the tactics we did were still the old infantry tactics which we'd done at Sandhurst, if you like to call it that. And there was very little of the forward-thinking tactics of the tank brigade being taught at Bovington at that time. I stand to be corrected on that, but that is the recollection that I have.
Would it be an exaggeration to say that as an enthusiastic young officer, flush with enthusiasm for this arm, you were somewhat disappointed by Bovington?
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so, because we had much to learn. And much of the learning we learned, I personally learned at Bovington, were many of the first principles of mechanical equipment, guns and tanks and so on, which one couldn't have learned anywhere else. And that much of those first principles, I think, stood one in very good stead throughout one's life.
Well, let's look at the training a bit. One of the courses was driving and maintenance, which for convenience I'd like to divide into two and just talk about the driving first. You were trained both on tanks and on armoured cars. What was the balance of attention given to both?
Well, we were mostly trained on the medium Mark II, as it was, the Vickers medium Mark II, which was the tank in service in two or three of the regiments at the time. The light tank was beginning to appear, but other than a cursory introduction to it, I don't think I was thinking of the Mark VI light tank, the three-man light tank, the earlier light tanks, of course, that is true. We obviously did drive as well. Armoured cars, we didn't do very much driving on, as far as I remember, very little, but then the armoured car was straightforward wheeled vehicle to drive, really.
I'm trying to get an idea of how much importance was attached to the car component of the tank corps equipment as compared with the tank in the training given.
Well, of course, the armoured cars were only in India, as far as the tank corps were concerned. The tank corps had no armoured cars in England. And I suppose that's probably why there wasn't much emphasis given to the armoured car. The guns, of course, we went through all through the normal basic training of the Vickers machine gun and the three-pounder, as it then was.
I'd like to come on to the gunnery in a couple of minutes. How was the driving training organised at Bovington in 35? How were new recruits?
We drove.
How were you introduced, and what kind of courses did you have to drive?
Well, we drove on the heath at Bovington. Mm-hmm. That's as far as it went. Well, I mean, of course, armoured cars and things, we drove on the roads, but as far as the tanks were concerned, we drove on the heath at Bovington, and the old medium didn't go very far or very fast, but it was mostly gear changing, steering, and, of course, the maintenance of the vehicle.
How
it worked and how you maintained it, how you kept it running.
How were you impressed as a new trainee tank officer with what was the main component of the army's mechanized force, namely the Vickers medium?
Well, I think one accepted it as the kit available at the time. And I think my generation was not perhaps brought up to be as inquiring, shall we say, as the present generation is.
Well, operating with the wisdom of hindsight, as much of the books on equipment do, you know, the medium is criticized for a number of reasons, but yeah. I wondered if the kind of criticisms that are commonly written were part of the awareness of people at the time, or whether, as you say, it was the machine and just accepted.
Yes, I think its shortcomings were known to us all. There wasn't, of course, a war on at the time.
Which ones were you most conscious of?
What?
The shortcomings.
Oh, I think its lack of armour. But again, I think that in doing one's basic training at that level, the combination of armour mobility and firepower and so on was not emphasised in the way, or not was not discussed in the way it is today.
Now, as far as the maintenance part of the D&M course is concerned, how detailed was the purely mechanical training?
Oh, I would have said it was extremely thorough, far more thorough than it is today. Well, that might be wrong. We went right into first principles. First principles of electricity and magnetism and mechanics and so forth and so on. I would have said it was very detailed. Within, of course, the limitations of the equipment that was then available.
Yes. When you say very detailed, exactly what do you mean? I mean, did you have to strip the tanks down and strip component parts of them down? Could you?
No, I don't think that quite so much. I think it was how it worked, was the explanation of how it worked, and the need to, for an epicyclic gearbox, to understand an epicyclic gearbox, you had to understand the principles of the epicyclic, and that sort of thing was explained to us, and we were taught that. Same with magnetos, ignition systems, and so on. We were explained how electricity was generated and how it worked. Those sort of first principles, which I doubt if they are so fully gone into today.
Did this amount of detail reflect a high degree of responsibility which tank commanders had at this time for maintaining their own machine?
Yes, because, of course, don't forget that the tank corps had its own fitters. There was ordnance, but there was no such thing as REME at that time. We had our own fitters, and therefore, also, I think, to keep the tanks of the day going required, one might say, infinite resource and sagacity, because it wasn't very easy. And that was true, and that applied right through the war, in the early years of the war, too. I mean, it was make and mend and cannibalize and all the rest of it, certainly in the early years of the war.
What were the most common faults, breakdowns, things like that, which you had to contend with on the machines you used?
I don't know. I suppose track trouble was probably the biggest bugbear, really. Track trouble, there was always steering problems with the medium.
And these things like track trouble and steering problems, these came within the realm of the tank commander's own responsibility as opposed to workshops, did they?
Yes, because if they're out on their own, then it was up to the crew to get the track back on again if they could. And of course they did in many cases too. Mm.
Let's move on to gunnery. What was the comparative attention given to the two Pandas on the one hand and the machine guns on the other?
Oh, I think it was a balanced course. But of course, I think there wasn't a great deal of firing because of shortage of money and shortage of ammunition. But we fired our courses as laid down at the time, and we went very thoroughly into the principles of the machine guns and the guns and so on.
Could you tell me a bit about the actual exercises you had to carry out in the gunnery course? I mean, the static exercises, the fire on the move exercises, any simulated exercises which may have been used at Bovington in the training program?
Well, of course, there was very little firing on the move, except in the light tank. But even then, the firing on the move was pretty hopeless. I think firing on the move wasn't really ever a scientific possibility until the stabilizer came in.
But nonetheless, it was a feature of the Bovington courses.
Oh, yes, it was.
Exactly how did they organize the firing training exercises? Could you give me some idea of the sort of physical circumstances in which they took place and how you carried them out? What I'm asking is if you could be a bit more specific about the training exercises themselves.
No, I don't think I can, really. And we obviously fired at moving targets because we had moving targets going along the ranges. The range, of course, was much smaller then than it is now. It was only the bit in front of the camp. And we must have done firing on the move within the limitations of the range. But, I mean, the range, if you look at it today, the old range, if you look at it today, is fairly, very small.
Do you recall the drill for the firing on the move that you did do?
No, not particularly. No.
In the gunnery course itself, did the kind of training you were given reflect the sort of roles that you were being prepared to carry out?
Oh, yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, definitely.
Well, what kind of roles did you feel you were being prepared for in the training?
Oh, I think almost entirely for a tank versus tank role, rather than an artillery supporting high explosive role, which of course is what we came to much more by the middle of the war.
Mm-hmm.
For those that were equipped with it. Yes, I mean direct fire, tank v tank sort of action.
This presumably came out mainly in the tactical course, which you mentioned was also a part of your training. How useful did you find the tactical course that you were given at Bovington?
Well, as I said before, my memories of the tactical course were that it was largely a repetition of the infantry tactics, basic principles, if you like to call it that, which we'd already done at Sandhurst. And that my impression is that we didn't discuss tank tactics as such nearly as much as we should have done.
Looking at the Bovington training as a whole and critically, what kind of judgment would you make of it as regards how well it equipped young officers like yourself for the sort of jobs you had to do?
Yes, that's right. No, I think it did very well. No, I think it did. I think it equipped us for as a tank corps officer very well. Obviously, there were enormous changes in equipment very quickly afterwards. But I think the basic trainings which we learnt at Bovington enabled us to take on this new types of equipment, power traverse and things like that, which came very shortly afterwards. We were able to understand and deal with. As a result of our basic training, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
When you'd finished your training, you went to Parham Down in the autumn of 36 to join the 1st Light Battalion, which actually wasn't there when you first got there.
Right.
But when it returned later in the year, did you find you were able very quickly and effectively to slot into the battalion, or did you feel like a trainee still for a while?
Yes, hard to say. When the 1st Battalion came back, of course, they all immediately went on leave, so there was a long gap where there were not very many of us there. And training didn't really get started until the spring, probably, of the following year. And, of course, the tanks that they brought back with them were all completely worn out, having come back from the desert. And it wasn't until we started to get the new Mark VI light tanks in the beginning of 37, that we were able to start training at all. I think one found one's place in the regiment much like anybody else.
I get the impression that all of the battalions of the tank corps throughout the interwar period had their own particular kind of character. Often it was reflected by their sort of sporting prowesses of various specialised kinds. Did the 1st Light Battalion, which was, of course, only formed in 1934, had it developed its own character as compared with the others?
Yes, I suppose it must have done. I think a lot of its character was probably bound up with its commanding officer, Vlad Kaunter, as he was known at.
A terrifying name.
That's right.
Did he deserve the name?
I think probably, yes, to a certain extent. Yes. In retrospect, now, in past times, time seemed to go very quickly. We did our sort of, you know, basic training, or troop training, individual training, troop training in the early part of 1937. And, of course, we had very few tanks to work on to begin with because they were only gradually coming. And they came, and then, of course, they broke down. History is repeating itself. They certainly broke down. They had various defects.
These were basically the
teething... These were the brand new Mark VI light tanks.
These were the teething troubles of a relatively new machine, were they?
Well, it was bad manufacture because the gearbox was out of line with the engine and all the clutches seized up one after the other.
This was the standard problem, was it?
This was the problem with the lot, yeah. And... However, we got around to going on manoeuvres on Salisbury Plain with the tank brigade in the summer, which I suppose must have been about July, August. I'd have to look and see. And then shortly after that, I went to Woolwich to the young officers' 6 months course at the Red Barracks at the Artillery College of Woolwich.
These mechanical problems with the Mark VI light tank interest me. You mentioned the gearbox being out of alignment. Were there any other problems with the machine?
Well, of course, we had the usual tank track problems. The tracks had a very short life and soon wore out and endlessly had to be adjusted and that sort of thing. I think those were the main problems. Of course, the driving, the tank was subject to reverse steering. And the drivers had to be trained and had to be careful.
Sorry, what does that mean?
Well, if you were going down a hill and pulled the right stick, you went to the left instead of to the right. If you had the engine on overrun and pulled the right stick, you would go to the left. And you could steer by that, but you had to know.
Yeah. This misalignment of the gearbox, was that the kind of problem you could deal with in the battalion, or did many of the machines have to go back to Vickers?
Oh, no, they had. This was a major modification problem which had to be done. And, of course, the manufacturers refused to believe the fitters in the first place, who said, this is out of line. It was denied by the manufacturers and denied by the authorities. But, of course, eventually they had to go back. And by that time, as I was always told at the time, they were already out of guarantee, if there was any guarantee.
I've often wondered how good communications were between the tank corps as the user and Vickers as the manufacturer in dealing with design and manufacturing problems.
Yes, I really can't speak for the detail of what the arrangements were in those days. There are people who could do. No doubt you've already interviewed them.
But no doubt.
But our impression was that we, you know, didn't get.
Yes, I appreciate you couldn't comment in any detail about that relationship, but from the point of view of how long it took faults to be dealt with, you presumably got some impression.
One's impression was it was far too long. You know, it took ages before anything happened.
How long?
But of course, it may not have been so very long, knowing how difficult it is to change the manufacturing processes and get the things back and modify them and so forth and so on.
Yes, I was going to ask you how long you thought ages was.
Well, of course, what was ages? May have not been so long.
You trained primarily on medium tanks at Bovington. You operated with a light battalion, light tank battalion at Perham Down. Did the training with the light battalion differ in either methods or in purposes, reflecting the different kind of roles for a light tank as compared with a medium?
Oh yes, I think it did entirely, because the medium was the role of the medium tank was more the sort of slow, close support kind of work, whereas the light tank work was much more the reconnaissance regiment type of activity. And we dashed about Salisbury Plain, and we did flank guards and advance guards and rear guards and things of that sort, rather than the main body of the tank force.
Sort of mechanized cavalry.
Well, that's right, yes. Oh, yes, that's what we were. And, of course, in due course, we handed the light tanks over to the cavalry.
Indeed.
Some bazaars to boot.
I said I wouldn't ask you any questions about very precise events, and I'm now about to ask you one such question. I think the only exercises, the only annual exercises you would have taken part in by virtue of the fact that you went to Egypt quite soon, would have been the 37 exercises at Tilshead.
Tilshead, yes.
Do you have any recollections of that annual exercises in terms of what its objects were, how far the aims were achieved, and any experiences you personally...
Regrettably not. I don't find any particularly events memorable. Unfortunately.
Well, we'll not flog a dead horse.
Unfortunately, I can't on that.
Yes. Were the light tanks fitted with wireless?
Oh yes, we had wireless. It was fairly elementary, and it was. And I doubt if we had more than perhaps say one wireless per troop. I doubt if we had a wireless in every tank. I'm pretty sure we didn't.
Yes.
At that time.
What sort of performance did those sets have? And did they have any deficiencies?
Well, I think they, were fairly cumbersome, difficult to keep on tune. If you could tune them and get through, you could pass messages and so on. It was... early days, but I thought that some of the signal officers who were with the armoured forces at the time would give you a better answer to that. They would have more of a definite feeling for it.
Was wireless the primary form for control and coordination?
Oh yes, I think so. Well, within say from regiment to company, as it was then, battalion to company, and possibly down to troops. But not, I would have said, within the troop. Within the troop, I think we used signals and, flag signals and hand signals and so on. Stayed within visual contact with each other.
I see. Mm-hmm. The young officer's course you went at in Woolwich, was it provided by Tank Corps establishment at Woolwich or by the Royal Artillery?
No, by the Royal Artillery, by the was what then was the School of Artillery, I suppose. Red Barracks at Woolwich, and it had... it was mostly an academic course, really, covering chemistry, physics, mathematics, of a fairly basic nature, mechanics... to a certain extent. Oh yes, mechanics and explosives and guns, all the applied subjects, very similar, I would have said, to the basic course at the armour school, the long officer's course at the armour school, which is still going on today. In those days, of course, it was compulsory for all tank corps officers to do it, but it was only 6 months.
How was the course regarded by young officers like yourself? Did you feel it to be a relevant and useful part of your training?
Yes, I think so. I certainly got a lot out of it. And when, in fact, I was working to go to Shrivenham in 1948, I was able to have recourse to my notes from that course to assist me to recall certain aspects of what I was required to know to go to Shimon.